She studied and did her PhD in Sao Paulo on perturbations in gravitational systems. And she also did a postdoc, or had some stint, at the Albert Einstein Institute in Potsdam. And after that, she became a professor at the Federal University of ABC. And she promised me she will explain what ABC means. And so she did research on various aspects of classical gravitational physics, including quasi-normal modes, gravitational wave signals, including from alternative models, which will be part of the talk, I guess, and neutron star physics and gravitational waves. Thank you.
It's supposed to work if the light is green, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, thank you guys very much for waiting until the last talk of the day. As Bianca said in the introduction, now we turn to something completely different. I was hired at the Center for Mathematics, Computation, and Cognition, whatever that is, in the Federal University of ABC, and I will have a slide explaining that. But I must admit that I'm actually a physicist working undercover in the middle of the mathematicians, and every now and then, I even dare to try to work with real astrophysical data. So my plan here is to give you a very non-comprehensive review of interesting fundamental physics that can be done with gravitational waves. And of course, there is lots more. Now, to get started, we know that in the beginning, there was some real doubt whether gravitational waves would be real or just some strange gauge effect that people were seeing in the general relativity equations. But now we have a clear understanding that yes, gravitational waves are real. We have even detected some gravitational waves, and I will be telling you more about that. And here is a nice cartoon summary of what we expect to be the sources of gravitational waves. But of course, we must also expect the unexpected, so there might be some completely different signals out there. We have seen so far signals coming from merger of binary systems. We also expect that there will be signals coming from supernova explosions, rotating neutron stars, pulsars can also generate gravitational wave signals if they have some asymmetry. And of course, we can have a stochastic background of unresolved sources. Okay, so about gravitational wave detectors, I was told to make this a talk for non-specialists, but please ask me if you have any more detailed questions. Please interrupt me at any point. We have here the two LIGO detectors in the United States. We have the Virgo detector in Italy. GEO-600 is in Germany, but that's mostly for development of technology. CAGRA, which is shown here in green as under construction, is now operational, but commissioning. And LIGO India is planned, but I understand those plans are moving along quite nicely after the first detection. This is a picture of CAGRA. So these detectors are the few kilometer long laser interferometers that are used for detecting gravitational waves. And these are amazing feats of technology. I have always known it in my heart that I was a theorist, so I'm very happy that other people have the gift for doing experimental physics. If it were for me, we would not have detected anything. And here we have a summary of the observation runs 01, 02, 03, 04, 05 that have already happened or are planned for LIGO, Virgo, CAGRA joining and LIGO India joining. And here, if you can see, we have distances in megaparsec, which are the distances up to which the detector should be able to see a binary neutron star merger. So we're expecting CAGRA to join in before the end of 03, which is the current run happening now, but it will start with very low sensitivity, and then they will build up on that.
The black holes, the images are larger.
Sorry?
For binary black holes, the
oh, yeah. Larger. Yeah, because the masses can be a lot bigger, yes. So neutron stars are kind of the standard at which these things are measured. So here's a nice pictorial view of the events that have already been detected and announced. So these include the events in the previous runs 01 and 02, but not yet in 03. For 03, we officially only have candidates, but no detections announced so far. We're all anxiously waiting for the LIGO announcement, probably early next year. So what do we have so far? We have here in purple, I guess, the black holes that have been detected through their electromagnetic radiation. So this is coming from their accretion disks, for instance, in X-rays. Here we have the masses of these objects. And here in blue, we have a depiction of the LIGO-Virgo events, the binary systems and the resulting black hole after the merger. So you can see that this looks like a very different population with higher masses. We really did not know that these black holes were there before they started being detected by LIGO. So that's the first very interesting bit of astrophysics that we are learning. And there is some interesting gymnastics in stellar evolution to explain how these heavier black holes are also formed. Down here, we have neutron stars with masses that have been determined, for example, neutron stars in binary systems. And here we have the one event of a binary neutron star merger that has been also detected by LIGO, resulting possibly in a light black hole, maybe in a very heavy neutron star. That's the interrogation mark that we have there. Okay. Now, if we think about this compact object, compact binary coalescence, this can be described in terms of three stages in spiral, merger, and ring down. As the objects are coming together, this can be very well described in post-Newtonian theory. The merger, which is exactly what the name says, can only be properly described in numerical relativity, and there are semi-analytical methods for describing it that have to be tuned back to numerical relativity, like EOB approaches, for example, that would be effective one body. And then after the merger, we have the ring down that can be very well described by linear perturbation theory, because the ring down can be approximated by a sum of the quasi-normal modes of the system. I'm going to explain to you what that is. Here is an image of the data of the first detection, and I just showed that because it's so nice that we now have finally data, right? That wasn't so clear when I started my PhD. Okay, so quasi-normal modes, and here this definition can be made as mathematically sophisticated as you want. So if you have questions, just ask me. But for our purposes, these are characteristic modes of oscillation of my compact object, okay? So these are going to be, as they are characteristic, they are independent from the initial perturbation. So they're like a fingerprint of the system that's emitting this radiation. They will form an infinite but countable set of modes that do not form a complete set. And maybe I'll expand on that a little bit. And in the general case that we have a rotating black hole, these are going to be solutions of the Tolkowski equation with appropriate boundary conditions that are outgoing at infinity, ingoing at the horizon. So what this means is that I don't have anything forcing the oscillations of the system. So I just have waves going away at infinity, waves going in into the horizon, and what I have as a solution of the wave equation with these boundary conditions is what we describe as the quasi-normal modes of the system. So we have here an example. This here is the in log scale, so it's easy to see what's going on. This initial bit is just a transient that depends on the initial perturbation that I gave. This is a very nice damped sine wave. So this is basically a damped harmonic oscillator. Black holes are very, very simple. I've also done work on neutron stars, and then things get a little bit more complicated. And then after this thing has decayed for like almost 10 orders of magnitude, then I have a power law tail that damps away the rest of the energy. Okay, so here in this part, this can be described as a damped harmonic oscillator, so with a complex frequency. Okay, so that means that if I, yes?
Where did that graph come from? Is it a simulation or is it linear perturbation theory? How did you get this graph?
Sure. This comes from the numerical solution of the wave equation. So if I'm working with Schwarzschild black hole, that means that I'm solving the Reggie-Wheeler equation or the Zerilli equation, which are just linearizations of the Einstein equations around the Schwarzschild background. If I'm working with a Kerr rotating black hole, the resulting equation is the Tolkowski equation. So this is the numerical solution of the linear equation. Okay? Now, the interesting thing is that if you do a numerical relativity simulation of a binary black hole system, you will see something like this limited to your numerical resolution after the merger.
And what initial wave function did you use for the simulation?
Okay, so here it doesn't really matter because the transient, this initial part here, is the only part that depends on your initial perturbation. So given that it's a linear equation, everything scales with the amplitude has no meaning here, and what's usually taken as the initial perturbation is a Gaussian pulse. So basically, a Gaussian pulse. Anything with compact support will do.
That's compact support outside the horizon.
Sorry?
Compact support outside
yes,
the horizon.
Yes, exactly.
What if you've taken something that was allowed to extend to the horizon?
Well, if it goes inside the horizon, my boundary conditions just say that it goes inside the horizon and it never comes back.
Yes, I know. Well, we can talk later.
Okay.
I just want to know, so you're seeing basically one quasi-normal mode in this? Is that right? The fundamental mode?
Yes, so this will be the fundamental mode. If I fit for that and subtract it from the signal, I will see the first overtone, but maybe that's clearer in the next slide. Okay, so as I was saying, if I work a little bit with that equation and I separate the angular variables and I choose a pair of LM harmonic indices here, my signal is going to be a sum of damped sine waves like that, where N is labeling the fundamental mode, the first overtone, the second overtone, okay? So here we have what the LIGO people were able to determine from the first gravitational wave detection, where they could clearly see the 2-2 mode, L equals 2, M equals 2, N equals 0, the fundamental mode. So here we have in the frequency and damping time space where these frequencies land. What's interesting is that for this signal, they were able to do a fit for this frequency and damping time just looking at the ring down and also compare it with the signal coming from the completing spiral merger ring down. Okay, so this is what's giving me the oscillation frequency of the mode. This is what's giving me the damping time of the mode. As I said, going up on N, I will call these overtones. If I choose L and M different from 2-2, which is the mode that should be excited with the larger amplitudes, I will call these higher harmonics, okay? Now, in the No-Hair theorem, I know that the space-time of a rotating black hole depends only on its mass and spin, and I'm completely neglecting electric charge because I'm concerned with astrophysical black holes. But this can change, for instance, if I have a different theory of gravity or a different theory altogether. For instance, if my black hole has scalar hair, maybe that could also be seen in the quasi-normal modes. From this detection, we could determine the first, the fundamental mode, but now the question is, can we detect more than one mode? Because if I detect these two numbers here and here, I can get these two numbers here and here. So that's not constraining anything. From two numbers, I get two other numbers. If I can detect another mode, I have a second pair of numbers that should be able to reproduce the same MNA there or start constraining variations from it. Okay, and this is the idea of black hole spectroscopy, to be able to observe more than one black hole mode. Okay, after this brief introduction, I'm going to be introducing you to my group, also answering the burning question of what does ABC mean in the name of my university, and then I'm going to be telling you some things that we have been doing. So this is just for a general global picture of how far away we are in São Paulo from here in Waterloo, Canada, because we share a continent, but it's still pretty far away. It's a lot farther away flying from São Paulo to here than flying to Europe, which is just over there around the corner. This here is a representation of the city of São Paulo, here painted in pink, and the bigger thing around it is the metro area. And in the metro area here in the southeast of São Paulo, we have different towns named, some of them, Santo André, São Bernardo, and São Caetano. And if you keep track of it, these names start with the letters A, B, and C. So the official name of our university is the Federal University of ABC, and nobody really thought this through. ABC means the ABC region in the metropolitan area of São Paulo, and it makes it rather embarrassing to present myself to other people at conferences. Hey, where are you based? The Federal University of ABC. No, we do not teach the ABC there. Yes. I have heard that joke before. Yes. Okay, this is a photo of our campus. This is a collection of the people that have been working in the group for the past year. Camilo, the postdoc, is now in Opava in Czech Republic, being very productive there. Luis Felipe is one of my PhD students who is here at PI spending 6 months. Yara is the other PhD student. She was here for a month, also supported by the Noether Fellowship. These are the undergrads. Diego is the master's student. Okay, so you're going to hear some of their names in what follows. So if I want to do black hole spectroscopy, where should we look? I mean, these are difficult measurements given the level of sensitivity that the detectors have now. So it would be really nice to know what exactly am I looking for. If I want to look for higher harmonics, so these would be modes other than the 2-2 mode, so the 3-3 mode or the 4-4 mode. And here I have the relative amplitudes normalized by the amplitude of the 2-2 mode for binary systems with masses, with mass ratio 1:1 to 10:1. So what we see is that if we are here at approximately equal masses, these things are contributing very little. They're contributing maybe tops about 5% in the amplitude. If we are here at very unequal masses, okay, so then they're contributing more, but also still like 30, not even 40% of the amplitude of the 2-2 mode. So if we want to do black hole spectroscopy, that means we are trying to find a subdominant mode, and that's going to be hard. It's also going to be harder because all of the detections so far have been compatible with equal masses, which means that these things are even less likely to be seen with larger amplitudes.
That plot refers to the includes the merger phase, right? So that's not the quasi-normal ringing only, the plot then.
This here?
Yeah.
This was obtained with in the EOB formalism.
Yeah, but still, so it includes merger phase.
Yes, exactly. Because these relative amplitudes need to come from the initial conditions that come from the inspiral and merger. Yes?
Just thinking about your spectroscopy, even with one mode, don't you already have two parameters, the real and imaginary parts of the...
Yes, but the thing is that it's not constraining. No, it's not constraining. Because given two modes, given two numbers, I get two numbers, and that's basically just a consistency check. I can calculate mass and spin from the frequency and damping time. So if the observers give me a frequency and damping time, I can calculate mass and spin, but I don't know if this result is correct. If they give me another mode, I can check.
So what you're after is a consistency check.
Yeah, so far we just have the consistency check.
There may be other ways of estimating mass or spin, but there's an internal consistency.
Yes.
Between those two estimates.
So the best accuracy is done using the entire inspiral merger ring down waveform.
Right.
Okay? But then again, you are just finding the best fit to describe your data. If you want to check how much it deviates or not from numerical relativity, you need to go beyond the best fit. Okay?
But
yes?
So I was under the impression that it was already done, that these parameters I extracted from just one of the phases and then actually separately from the other phase and compared. So
yes, so this, but still, this is kind of like just a consistency check. Everything falls together very nicely, and this is really good. So when people talk about checking whether Einstein is still right, yes, Einstein is still right. But the inspiral merger ring down contains the ring down, right? So I can calculate the ring down separately, and it's consistent with the rest. So that just tells me that things aren't wrong. But it's not really constraining.
Also, in the numerical simulations, the final parameters are really extracted using something at the horizon. So it's not really directly related to the waveform. And there are, the uncertainties are significant there. It's not, so therefore I think one needs the ring down, this consistency check, one really needs it. It's not that the numerical waveform, relativity gives you unambiguously the mass and the spin. It really has to do with the calculation of horizon. I can tell you more about it.
Okay, so another problem is that given the uncertainties that we have in frequency and damping time, maybe one could even be unsure which is the mode that we see. We do expect that we are seeing the fundamental 2-2 mode, but there could be an overlap with different modes as well. Okay, so what if now instead we look for overtones in the data? And this is work that my student Yara and I just posted in the archive a couple of weeks ago. So if we're looking at the relative amplitude of the first overtone to the fundamental 2-2 mode, well, it has much larger amplitudes compared to the 2-2 fundamental mode for the equal mass case, as you can see here. So given that what we are seeing is mostly towards equal masses, this looks like a much more promising way to go. There have been preliminary results looking into fitting the data using just the first mode with the second mode with the third mode, and they seem to show some evidence for the first overtone to be seen in the data. But more confident identification may need a detection of SNR of approximately 30, which is even larger than the first detection. So maybe we need to wait more, or maybe we need to combine more detections, but this seems to be a promising way to go.
So what is the difference between what this is and the Caltech-Cornell work? The Caltech-Cornell work about the overtones and saying, are you going to talk about that? Just briefly.
I was not going to go into that detail, but very briefly, what they do is that they fit seven modes to the ring down, starting at the peak of the amplitude. And one has to be a little bit careful doing that because with seven overtones plus the fundamental mode, you're fitting 16 parameters to your numerical relativity data or to your real data, right? And Starting at the peak, we expect that non-linearities could be very important. So what we tried to do was to find the best, find the point at which the signal is best described by the sum of the first two modes. But we can talk more about it in detail later. Our results are compatible with what they find, but we treat it in a slightly different way. Okay, so now let's talk about interesting and highly speculative physics that we can also do. So I have been talking about these binary black hole detections, but let's just consider for a second that we are not seeing black holes, but we are seeing something that looks very similar to a black hole. And there are motivations for doing that. So we can think about non-singular black holes, black hole mimickers, exotic compact objects. The way these things have been named has changed with time, but this is not a very new idea. So we have to think, why do I want to work with alternative models? I mean, am I not happy with black holes? I'm personally very happy with black holes. I'm not advocating for any of these models. But as scientists, we can only discard a model if we have good reason to do it. So people doing quantum gravity here can maybe think of some quantum gravity considerations and might be happier if there were no event horizons or no singularities and no black hole information paradox and all these complicated things that come together with classical black holes. Well, I could also think, but why bother, right? Haven't I even seen a photo of the black hole? The black hole is there, right? Okay, but maybe it's not quite there exactly. It might be really hard to give irrefutable proof of the existence of the event horizon as mathematically defined. So we have some wiggle room there to test different possibilities. Okay. So I found this picture on the internet and I find it awesome because this is showing lots of different alternative models that have been proposed. I don't think that these are the original illustrations from the papers in which they have been proposed, but I think they are awesome. So we have different things. We have gravastars, boson stars, wormholes, superspinners, and stuff here that I don't even know what they are, to be honest. But there have been lots of different models proposed. If I want to look into one of those, I happen to have looked into the gravastar that was proposed in 2004 by Mazur and Mottola. And here the idea, I'll try to explain it very quickly. I have a massive star that at the end of its life is collapsing. And classically, it would form a black hole. But in this alternative picture, it does not form a black hole. The gravastar stands for gravitational vacuum condensate star. This is a perfectly good solution of the Einstein field equations, as I will explain. It can be made almost as compact as a black hole, but with no event horizon or central singularity. Okay, so what happens in this collapse, in this alternative picture, is the creation of an interior de Sitter core surrounded by a shell of stiff matter. And the way it happens is highly speculative because it would depend on a theory of quantum gravity that we do not yet have. So I'll leave that as it is. If you want to know more, you can ask me later. We looked into the quasi-normal mode signature of a gravastar. And here my parameters are mass, radius of the core, or surface radius, or and surface radius. Or I can describe it in terms of the mass, the thickness of the shell of matter, and the compactness of the object. So here in the complex frequency space, this is a Schwarzschild black hole. And for a non-rotating gravastar, depending on the thickness of the shell and the compactness of the object, my quasi-normal modes for the fundamental 2-2 mode follow along this line. If I add rotation from the Schwarzschild black hole, I have the track of the quasi-normal modes for Kerr black hole. For the gravastars, I break the degeneracy here according to their compactness. And if I compare that with what has been determined for the first gravitational wave detection with the observational uncertainties, I see that there is no overlap if I take the same spin for the black hole. So this is a way of showing that, okay, so the quasi-normal mode signature of this alternative model does not match what has been observed. Yes?
What was the dynamics that you linearized to then get the quasi-normal
constant? It's the Einstein field equations.
Because, I mean, so
here
one
we
would
are
expect that the Gravastar is a solution of the classical Einstein equations, right? I mean, so one would expect in general that it's
the
solution to some modified.
No. The Gravastar is a perfectly good solution of the Einstein field equations. All that you need to do is to glue the different patches of metric together using the Israel junction conditions. But it's an equilibrium solution of the Einstein equations. So although it could be formed using some contribution from a theory of quantum gravity, the final equilibrium solution can be classically described in general relativity.
Okay, maybe we can discuss later. But
sure.
I think it depends on what you actually do with the quantum gravity bit of whether you will actually have a modified dynamics. But yeah. That's
okay,
different.
We can talk more about that later, and I would be very happy to learn more about the quantum gravity side of it. Okay, so what else can we do? If we do it really, really classically now, we know that in 1916, Schwarzschild found this black hole solution, but it's sometimes overlooked that Schwarzschild also described the interior solution of the Schwarzschild metric, which describes a uniform density star, which is going to have a central pressure given like this, and if I require that the pressure is everywhere positive, the central pressure is positive, I'm going to find that the radius of the uniform density star has to be larger than 9/8 the Schwarzschild radius of the same mass. And if we do a radial stability analysis of this uniform density stars, we're going to find that it requires a critical adiabatic index to have, it requires that the critical adiabatic index be finite for the star to be stable. So if we see it here, this value of the critical adiabatic index for the fluid perturbation in this uniform density star, it's going up, 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 and it's exploding here at the same limit, which is the Buchdahl limit. So this is further indication that I cannot take my uniform density star and compress it first further than 9/8 of the Schwarzschild radius. But actually it can be done. And what happens is that if you cross that limit, you can find some stable solutions. You can find some equilibrium solutions that have negative pressure inside, a divergence inside, and a positive pressure that goes to zero at the surface. And this is a little bit weird, and of course nobody likes diverging pressures, but these things can be regularized in terms of Komar integrals. And what we find is that as we go closer and closer to the Schwarzschild radius, I have P equals minus rho constant inside divergence surface. So this is kind of looking like a Gravastar, something with a negative pressure inside. And then what we did with Camilo Posada, who was a postdoc in the group then, was to reproduce this radial stability analysis. And here we see the normal, less compact stars, the divergence at the Buchdahl limit, and then it goes back. So stability is actually regained as we approach the Schwarzschild radius. So that's a very interesting thing that one can do, just exploring analytical solutions and looking at how viable these alternatives can be. Now, something else that can be done, and this is more of a model-independent formulation, is to think about my compact object black hole alternative, and I say, okay, I'm not going to be describing what's inside this object. It can be anything. I don't have a model for it. But let's just say it has a surface very close to the event horizon. So I can modify my scattering problem, which is what I solve for in the linearized perturbations, here the outgoing conditions at infinity, the ingoing conditions at the horizon. And now what I have is the same potential barrier, and here is the surface, right? So then what happens is that if this object is compact enough that I have this potential well here, what I see in the ring down after a merger is going to be initially the scattering on this potential barrier, which is exactly the same as I had here. And that's going to be the same black hole quasi-normal modes that I would see if this was an actual black hole, okay? But then where do I see the signature that this is not a black hole? Well, if I wait a little longer, the modes that were trapped in here are going to start leaking out as some echoes of the event, as they have been branded. So what I have here is the initial black hole quasi-normal mode decay, and then I could have these things coming out later on. There have been claims of detections of these echoes in the data, and there is some ongoing controversy on that. I refer to you here some references. Now, one interesting thing to think is that the initial calculations have all been done without rotation. And of course, if we want to compare with actual data, these objects need to be rotating. And if they are rotating, we need to worry about something called the ergo region instability. Here, for example, for gravastars, this is the maximum compactness that an object can have as a function of the angular momentum. And I'm splitting this parameter space into stable configurations and unstable configurations. So for the same angular momentum, if I make the object more compact, it becomes unstable. So this is a linear instability. And the modes should be growing exponentially, but they can do so with a very long growth time. It has been shown that this instability can be quenched if the object has absorption. That means if reflectivity is less than one. Of course, if reflectivity goes to zero all the way, I have a black hole. But then if I add rotation, what happens with the echoes? And this is work from Luis Felipe, my other PhD student, that is going to appear in the archive, hopefully in the next week or so. And what we saw is that if I use an infalling particle falling into this object to excite the quasi-normal modes, the waveform is going to depend on the orbit. And that's not just the transient, it's the actual waveform, because the frequencies are going to be different. If I have a co-rotating orbit or a counter-rotating orbit, I have different frequencies. This guy falls faster. This guy falls lower. The frequencies are different. So if I look at the first, second, and third echoes in the co-rotating and in the counter-rotating case, there is a clear difference between them. So if we are able to see these things, giving them a correct interpretation might be a little bit harder than anticipated. Okay.
In this case, you know the exterior solution. I mean, you said that you don't care how it formed, but you assume certain exterior solution, right? With the ergo region.
Yes. So the exterior solution in this case, where I don't care about what's inside, the exterior is approximated to be the Kerr solution, the Kerr metric. We know that there is no Birkhoff theorem for axially symmetric spacetimes, but if you make the compactness tend to the black hole compactness, all the moments tend to the Kerr values. Okay, so this is what I had to say. I think that we are living in a time with very exciting prospects for testing gravity and learning more about different objects that can exist in the universe. And again, we might find things that we have not been looking for, but we need a little bit of caution, because to be able to give a definite answer to some questions, we might need a higher signal to noise ratio. So we have to be worried that we are not claiming things that cannot be properly substantiated by the data at this stage. Data stacking which is combining data from different detections, might help us improve our sensitivity. And we're going to have third generation ground detectors around in the 2030s. LISA, the laser interferometer space antenna, is going to fly in 2034. And the signal to noise ratio for LISA is going to be huge. When LISA flies, we're going to be able to see everything we want to see from the data. But maybe you don't want to wait until 2034, and we want to do this sooner, okay? Thank you very much.
More questions to Cecilia?
Yes?
No?
Yes.
Well, this is something that maybe we can continue to discuss afterwards, but I'm very skeptical about, see, when you, in the very beginning, you quoted the boundary conditions that everyone uses to define, essentially everyone uses,
mm-hmm.
to define the quasi-normal mode,
mm-hmm.
and that is that the wave form should be, the wave, how to say,
Yeah,
it should be going in towards the horizon, near the horizon,
and outgoing
and
at
out
infinity, to give you characteristic oscillations.
Personally, I don't think there's a good argument for saying that it has to be inward, near the horizon.
Sorry, I was just going to say that a different way of defining what the complex frequencies of the quasi-normal modes are is that they are the poles of the Green function.
Yes, but then it's some sort of retarded principle. I mean, I don't think that's not going to change, I think, what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Which it seems to me that the right boundary, the only boundary condition that we can reliably know about at the horizon is that the waveform should be, the waveform, this master function, or whatever you call this scalar field, should be regular there. It should be finite and maybe extendable across the horizon. And if you take that point of view, because, you know, because what's the rationale for saying it should be inward at the horizon? The only rationale that I can think of is, well, nothing can come out of the horizon. So how can that be? But just by that very fact, nothing can come out of the horizon. It means you don't need a special boundary condition. Whatever initial wave function you choose, nothing will come out of the horizon. So my point of view for a while has been that just finiteness or regularity is the real criterion. If you look at this, you see that only certain normal, you see that the fundamental mode is uniquely picked out, but the higher, I'm assuming we have like 5 minutes, is that not true?
Nothing, you don't need to take up all of the 5 minutes.
But
let me finish the last. And you see that the higher overtones merge into a continuum above some point. That's what you find. And there are no more discrete quasi-normal modes.
Oh no, but there are. There are.
Well, it depends on the boundary condition.
No, the whole power of quasi-normal modes have been calculated for different black holes with also configurations with more than one horizon, like Heisen-Nordstrom or Kerr.
Yes.
And what happens is that if you look at it in the complex frequency plane, they start going up in the imaginary part, because that means smaller damping time, shorter and shorter damping times,
yes.
Right? But there is a spacing in the real frequencies, so they do not all collapse. And actually, the spacing between the asymptotically highly damped quasi-normal modes has been suggested as a way to find the quantum of the horizon area for the black holes as a measure for that, for the black hole thermodynamics.
Okay, so let me suggest everyone interested in the definition of construction of quasi-normal modes can stay here.
I'm going to be surprised how many people are interested in the construction of quasi-normal modes.
Or alternatively, you can choose to go to the disco and get discuss it over beer. Otherwise, I'm happy that we managed to finish.
this conference, let's thank Chia again. It was a very nice talk.
Thank you.